So Anya, we've been talking a lot about CPG and retail and how it seems to be becoming harder out there. It's the case, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it because of diminishing demand? I guess it depends on which category we're talking about it. Because as we were just discussing before we started filming, we talked about one category where it is a demand, a demand issue. But
shrinking demand.
And there's maybe one play for that, or you know, a set of plays for that. But then there's also where it's not that it's shrinking demand, it's just the dynamics have changed.
Yeah.
In the market.
Absolutely. I mean, the playing fields have totally shifted from, let's say, even 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And so now I like to think it's like a never normal, right? So it's really volatile. A good indicator of what's happening in CPG is just if you look at all the top CPG companies right now, most of them are going through a CEO shift as well.
Right.
So there's a lot of churn. And that is also indicative of what's happening in the industry, which is the volatility and the fact that you know, it's tougher than ever.
Yeah, and what is it? What are some of the dynamics that have changed? So, if it's not in the cases for a category where it's not shrinking demand, mm-hmm. what are some of the things that have become more volatile?
Yeah. So, first of all, planning. So, consumer behavior. You know, before you would have your insights, you'd have your consumer trends, you'd be able to plan very clearly when there were going to be spikes and peaks and troughs, etc. Now, with the market being the way it is, and actually with just Gen Z, millennials, etc., you know, it's not as predictable. So demand planning is becoming more important than ever. And obviously you want to make sure that you have just enough stock on hand as well.
Right.
So I think that's been a big shift across pretty much all categories, I would say.
So what is it about the demand planning? It's like having a plan that you can rely on, kind of, that's predictable.
Yeah.
I think that's a word that we've discussed.
Yeah, so there's predictability, but there's agility as well.
Right.
So, you know, beforehand, you would plan 3 months, 6 months in advance. And now you obviously need to do that, but you need to be agile. So you need to be able to source your raw materials and your goods in a far shorter lead time. And then on top of that, you overlay that with tariffs, you overlay that with obviously, you know, sustainability, et cetera. It's a lot more complex than it was before. And so I think for me, what I'm seeing is that is probably become more important than ever when, you know, in CPG, like demand and planning is essential.
Is loyalty dead, so to speak? Or has it just changed how it manifests?
Yeah, I think it's just changed how it's manifests itself. At the same time, consumers are more fickle, right? There's obviously your usual factors like price.
Yeah.
But now you overlay that with how quickly the world is moving, and you only need to have, you know, one bad message in the press or on social media. There's some really good examples of brands that have been impacted by bad press, especially in cosmetics, actually.
Right.
From going from, you know, triple digit growth to triple digit decline in the space of less than 12 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so it's less about that brand loyalty and that stickiness. It's more about being relevant.
Absolutely. Relevant in culture. So, yeah, I mean, no longer can you just rely on one or two channels. And by that, I mean, first of all, through, you know, your traditional distribution channels. You need to be wherever the consumer is. But then you also need to think about, you know, your media channels as well. So being culturally relevant wherever, you know, people are absorbing or using media.
Yeah, absolutely. When we were talking earlier, we came up with three kind of challenger statements. And I think it'd be fun to just kind of go through those if we could. So
absolutely.
The first one is most CPG businesses are still planning for loyalty, as we've just discussed. Consumers have already moved on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about that. So, as you said, planning hasn't caught up.
Yeah.
But how does planning need to change? Maybe that's a good way to think about it. There's so many different data points and factors now. It's almost difficult if you know, having grown up in, let's say, a less volatile world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can relate to it because I was doing planning many years ago, right?
Yeah.
And I planned the annual calendar. I knew exactly what was happening, when and why. So I had a very clear strategic plan. I had my strategy, and that's what I planned to. Also took into consideration lead times, et cetera. But now it's so much more complex. And if you just look at different challenges around planning in different categories as well, right? So if you look at cosmetics, right? there are so many newcomers in cosmetics, and in cosmetics, it's all about innovation and technology, right? If you aren't really at the forefront of trends, latest tech, etc., you're already behind.
Right.
So you're old news, right?
And is the around that with in a, where challengers can really attack, you know, the established brands?
Absolutely. And you look at the likes of e.l.f.
Yeah.
I mean, e.l.f. is a perfect example. I can't even count the number of the consecutive number of positive quarters they've had now. I think it's something crazy, right? It's like 20 or something. But e.l.f. just keeps growing from strength to strength. And although the interesting thing is its distribution is very mass, right? Actually, it also appeals to a very premium consumer as well.
Right.
Because they really are rooted in culture.
They're in culture and conversation.
And they also have the latest technology.
Right.
Right. So it's a great example of how they've done fantastic work. And then you look at Rode. Rode is Hailey Bieber's brand. Mm-hmm. I mean, that brand was nothing to 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And obviously now e.l.f. has just acquired Rode. And I can't remember the number off the top of my head, but it was around a billion.
Big valuation.
Yes. And I just read yesterday that Hailey Bieber was saying her goal is to be everywhere. Once again, rooted in culture, really relevant. Great performance. Yeah. So yes, challenger brands in the world of cosmetics,
yeah,
for sure.
Well, let's talk about a category that I know, one of the categories you know well. I know you know cosmetics very well, but you also know alcoholic beverages very well based on your experience. How is that? Are we seeing the same types of things there? We talked a little bit more about the shrinking demand.
Yes. And that's if I go back to my point before, is that actually planning impacts different categories, right? So cosmetics, you hear what I'm saying, it's about being agile, being on point, in culture, latest technology, and look at what's happening across Korean brands as well in beauty now as well. So that's one point. Then you look at AlcBev. It was always planned very seasonally, right? And you had a very clear idea of your volumes and what needed to happen. Just like everybody else in COVID, obviously, there was a huge pressure on liquid. And now we've had a total bullwhip effect, right? And now on top of it, you've had the whole season of moderation that's come in as well and a shift of how people drink. So you've got, one, you've still obviously got to, you're not planning with the same sort of seasonality. And then you've also got to take into consideration that the occasions of when people are drinking has shifted and changed as well. So it's the consumer insights that need to be overlaid as well, culturally.
And it's the speed of getting that insight to the decision point.
I think that's where it'll make or break success.
Right. Tell me a little bit more about that.
In years gone by, there was consumer insights and they did their work. And they normally, that helped marketing decide what was needed to be launched and how to go about it. And then you had supply and planning on the other side, and they were doing their thing. To me now, it all needs to be integrated.
Right.
So it's a shift in ways of working, thought processes, and also data gathering.
Yeah, and you've talked a little bit about, I mean, so ways of working, that's really around how we govern, how we what are the decisions, who makes the decision, how do we make that decision, what are the inputs? And we hear about the elusive one number across demand, supply, sales, et cetera. But how does that really change how your operating model needs to work and also the journey of getting from the insight to the impact in the market?
Yeah. Well, by nature, CPG companies tended to be quite process-driven and very hierarchical, right? And that's sort of how they were successful. You know, you would have your annual strategy in, or even three-year strategy. I remember doing 10-year strategies. That's crazy, right? Anyway, And that's what you were working towards, right? And then you had slight volatility in your reaction, et cetera. Now, I mean, I think if you're doing a plan for anything longer than a year, it's almost defunct, right?
Right.
Right. It means that the ways of working have totally shifted. You need to be more agile, which means that you don't want to have as much hierarchy. You want to have a lot more flat structures. You want to have, ensure that there's more autonomy within the organization. And then on top of it, you want to make sure that, you can encourage a growth mindset. So less rigid thinking and process. Now, I'm not suggesting that, you know, you cut corners, and I'm certainly not suggesting in the world of cosmetics or even in Elk Bev that you're not doing the necessary testing.
Sure.
And governance, but you just have to go to market far quicker. And what you are actually seeing is that it started more in cosmetics, but actually a lot of brands would use labs outside of their own so that they could bring brands quicker to market, right?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I was going to go exactly there. So on the product innovation side of the
house,
We talk a lot about the planning and the inventory and the promotions and the management, but what about the product itself?
Absolutely.
And the price back architecture and the...
And then what's obviously, as you know, if you're really focused on innovation, that comes at a cost and that impacts your P&L. So what I've seen is a lot of companies are actually outsourcing a lot of their innovation in really dynamic sort of agile hubs. And then they obviously bring that innovation and technology back into the master brands, let's say.
Yeah, and we've seen the same thing. I mean, I'm spending a lot of time in the US, and that's one trend I'm massively seeing.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to be able to get that. It's not that your product innovation teams aren't capable to do it. No. It's just sometimes you just need someone on the outside to be able to just take something, an idea, and get it to the market fast. Yeah. What about experimentation? And because that, you know, that
well,
is one aspect.
Well, unfortunately, when costs are tight, performance is stretched. That's the first thing that
you don't
tends
have a lot of
go.
Room for experimentation.
Yeah, yeah. So that's where actually ring fencing, you know, your innovation and ensuring that your P&L is not impacted is a really good idea.
But to challenge that a little bit, in an experimentation that's built in within the product development process.
Yes.
So like just like basically cheap experimentation. Mm. So how can we like get to the inside as fast and as cheaply as possible as part of the development process? Whether that means like, hey, we're going to be in 5 stores and we're going to do shelf intercepts, for example.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
No, absolutely. I mean, I agree with you. I think it's test and learn, reiterate, right? And go and have your test markets. And I personally believe gone are the days that you can wait for something to be 100% perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, you've talked a lot about the certainty that we've had in the past.
Yes. So now it's like how do you manage an uncertainty? How do you evolve in a never normal world, right? So if you're waiting for something to be 100% perfect, I think you've already missed the boat, right? So you've got to go out there and test. And then obviously you iterate as you go along. And you can do that generally not in your formulas, right? Or in your core product, because you've got to trust that you have an exceptional product. By that, I'm talking about your media strategy or your price architecture.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even your distribution channels and your geographic markets, right? Because we do know in CPG, the companies that are really withstanding the pressures, right, are the ones that have more geographic spread.
Okay. So it's a natural hedge, having a geographic spread.
Correct.
Hedge.
Yeah.
Geographic spread, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. So if we know the US is under pressure, well, then you've got Asia.
Emerging markets,
right?
Yeah.
And I think the other interesting thing is that you are seeing, and it depends on the category, but especially in Elk Bev, like we know Africa is a huge growth opportunity, and that's where you are seeing a lot of innovation or investment as well.
Yeah, it's been a great promise, Africa. I must say I don't have the data, but, you know, the narrative that I've heard is, yeah, there's been a lot of promise for decades about Africa, but we haven't seen it quite materialize.
Yeah, but that's why I'd say it depends on the category.
Okay.
Because in Elk Bev, yes.
Right.
Right. Not so much in, let's say, cosmetics. And I wanted to talk about the mobility,
sure,
like bicycle industry a bit, because when we go back to the conversation around demand planning, that's a really interesting situation where there's more than 300 parts in a bike. Some of the lead times are more than 12 months. So, you know, your demand planning needs to be ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, and I know because I've been there, one thing that hasn't necessarily happened is you've made sure that, you know, you've hedged against tariffs and everything else, but not what the consumer is going to be doing.
Right. Right.
Perfect example of, and we can see that in the news every week. There's another company that's falling over or struggling when it comes to the bicycle industry.
Yeah, and I mean, as a cyclist myself, I know you're also a cyclist. It feels so strange to me because I feel like cycling's never been more popular.
Yeah.
And so as a consumer, it feels very strange to me. And
yeah.
But you don't see what's behind the scenes.
You absolutely don't see what's behind the scenes. And actually, you're right. I mean, the average consumer doesn't see the pressure that's happening. But if you look at pricing, you'll see what's happening because pricing is a telltale sign. You know, the thing with especially electric bikes is that there is a life cycle on a battery ride. And so you need to be making sure that you're building bikes and your lead times are anything up to a year. So you've got all your parts coming in. So, and then unfortunately, like every industry, it's also, you know, built through innovation.
I was going to say, so the battery minute, innovation.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're stacked with all these parts.
Goes back to my manufacturing days, modular design so that you can actually change out the battery.
Yes.
Is that happening?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And what you have seen is that because of the necessity to change the way they've behaved in the past, the bike industry has become a lot more agile. And you are seeing, well, you're seeing less innovation, but when they do go to market, they go big.
Very good. Well, we talked a little bit about technology, but we haven't talked about AI yet. And that's surprising in this day and age when everyone only talks about AI, it seems sometimes.
Yeah.
So let's dig into it. So, and the relevance for CPG and retail. Yeah. So AI, we've talked about how it doesn't just support decision-making anymore. It actually automates entire parts of your organization, entire processes.
Yeah.
In fact, the way that I'm kind of describing it and the way I'm seeing it manifest is it's really about reimagining how we work.
Yes, correct.
So tell me a little bit about your experience. You know, is AI even the right conversation, or is it something else where AI is an enabler?
This is my opinion. Obviously, I see AI as an enabler, right? So for me, first of all, is what is the problem that you want to solve, right? And so if we need to build value or we need to cut costs, then what's the best way to go about it? And 9 times out of 10, AI is going to be there to solve your problem, right? So for me, it's less about saying, okay, oh, how do I use AI and where can I plug it into my organization?
Right.
And for me, it's more like take a step back, zoom out. Okay, where can we potentially add more value? And value could be agility. Value could be speed to marketing innovation, consumer insights, making sure a really good example, and it's being used across most CPG companies right now is marketing assets, right? So tailoring marketing assets to your different retailers and your different channels. And you're able to do that in breakneck speed versus
the old model of sending a brief to an agency
and then waiting for weeks and then, you know, number of iterations, etc.
Yeah.
So that's an immediate cost saving.
Yeah, and we're seeing the agency model fundamentally change. If you look at what agencies are doing, they're becoming tech companies.
Yeah.
So in the marketing space, we're even hearing major retailers describe themselves as tech companies more than retailers.
Yeah.
We saw the same with banking about 10 years ago, actually. A lot of statements by CEOs saying, you know, we're no longer a bank as described in the past. We're a tech company providing a digital service.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you only looked at the news, read in the news a week ago, Walmart sees themselves as a tech company now. L'Oreal, actually, the world's biggest beauty company by far, they saw themselves as a tech company years ago. And they invest heavily in tech, right? So, and that's where, you know, their agility and the fact that they can always be on point when it comes to trends is driven a lot by their tech,
right?
It's less about utilizing your various parts of your business and being experts in these various, you know, in certain parts like just planning or just consumer insights or just marketing. And how do you bring that together using AI?
I fully agree with you, by the way. I mean, I think we had an era of let's define a lot of use cases for AI and let's experiment with them. By the way, it wasn't an unproductive phase. There was a lot of learning out of that use case development, but certainly it becomes very difficult or even impossible to scale. And so what we've definitely learned and what we're doing in the market is helping companies take that step back and reimagine the journeys end to end.
Yeah.
And how do we need to work envisioning how we can use tooling across every step in a process? To achieve the value you talked about, which is agility and speed to market and being able to take the consumer insight and get it into the decision that gets into the action that hopefully delivers the result.
Absolutely. I think where I've seen AI integrated into the business and do an exceptional job is where you've had support from senior leaders and across the organization. So everybody's fully embedded in the decision and aligned on the decision, but also you've taken into consideration that the ways of working need to change as well.
So is this a leadership exercise?
Yes, it is. Absolutely.
Okay, tell me, let's talk about that for a moment.
Well, like I said, where I've seen it work well is where leadership have said, okay, this is what we're going to be doing. We're going to be testing and learning along the way. We don't have all the answers, but we're going to go for it. But we're also going to make sure that we have the right resource. So somebody owning the project, maybe looking at how it impacts the various departments or different teams. So constantly reiterating and reimagining what the future decision-making process looks like.
Yeah,
that's where I've seen it work very well. Where I have seen it not work well is where, you know, there's been a great idea, if there's been a test case in one part of the business, but there hasn't been full alignment that this is where we're going to go. And we definitely haven't thought about, okay, how is it going to impact people in their day-to-day roles?
Right.
So it's almost like pushed.
And there's kind of two ways. So I fully agree. One of the things that I've really learned over the years is that an operating model exercise is really a leadership exercise. Absolutely. That's the fundamental premise of what it really is. It can be hard to change an organization that's, especially large ones that are complex, to really turn the ship around in a new direction, or even, you know, kind of chip away at that large organization. So one of the techniques we do see is like, how do we incubate a new way of working and then actually scale that up? Have you seen examples of that?
100%. But I also have to say that where it's worked well is we've had external partners supporting us as well, because, you know, it's still business as usual. And a lot needs to get done, and we're all under pressure, right? So if you're trying to create a transformation using the same amount of people with the same amount of hours in the day, that's where it becomes really difficult.
Yeah.
So where it worked really well is where we had an external partner who was basically challenging us as well. And we managed to deliver far more quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of, I'm a big fan of Geoffrey Moore, and he wrote a book decade ago called Zone to Win, and everyone who knows me will laugh as I mention this because I always talk about it. I think it still holds true today. Essentially, you know, kind of on the running the business side, or, you know, improving what you have side, that's a very different muscle. That's a very different exercise than incubating something completely new or transforming something significantly. So yeah, I fully agree. Like, and most companies are not engineered to be transforming. They're engineered to run in
But especially not in supply chain.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Because actually what you're looking for is, you know, is reliability, consistency. You know, that's what you're looking for. And now all of a sudden you're asking somebody to like totally shift their mindset.
Yeah.
And walk towards something where they don't know what the outcome's going to be.
Right.
And that's very nerve-wracking.
And so it is a big culture shift.
Yes.
I think that's really important. As you know well, we focus a lot on the cultural aspects of this change. And it's something that I don't think you can do a program of change of any size or impact without really focusing on the cultural aspect of it. And it's not just change management, like let's manage the stakeholders, let's communicate well, let's train people. It goes beyond that. It goes beyond, hey, how do the leadership team see this change together, and are we fully aligned, and are we seeing it with the same context? And once we see it with the same context, how can we enroll the rest of our leaders and the rest of the organization in that new paradigm? And it really is, I think, how that context, which is so important.
Yeah, and I'm smiling because I also think that alongside AI comes a different type of leadership, as you've mentioned, which is understanding that you don't have all the answers.
Right.
And that can sometimes show vulnerability as well, right? So it's just a it's a really different way of thinking, and a lot more risk taking, calculated risks, obviously. But yes, I think leadership in itself is changing.
Yeah,
just like businesses.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point. I fully agree. It's really a new era. We say this, but this is truly a new era of leadership that's required. In a way, as a leader, if you've had 3 decades of leadership,
yes.
and now you have to be complete, you have to not completely different, but you have to really embrace something that is quite different from how we've grown up and how we've worked. So where's the next generation of leaders going to come from?
Well, I think it's a combination.
And are we seeing that in some of the changes in leadership that we're seeing across some
yes.
of the
yes,
companies
yes, yes.
out there?
I think so, for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's a combination. I think that, you know, you have to be a continuous learner, right? And so the individuals or the leaders of tomorrow are fully aware that they need to learn, adapt, and change. And the, unfortunately, I believe if you're not prepared to do that, then you will be left behind.
Yeah.
But I also believe that to build great leaders of the future for tomorrow, you also need great leaders today. Right. So there's the mentorship, it's the guidance, the experience. Yeah. So it has to be a combination.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
You talked about risk taking. So, you know, being vulnerable, experimenting with going into areas where the certainty is certainly not there. Those are really important characteristics of today's leader. I think we could do a whole video on that, Anya.
Yeah. And I'm not an expert in that, but I do think that it's linked to AI. What we learned about AI 12 months ago is now defunct. Like, things are moving that quickly. So, you need to create an environment where your team are aware that nothing stays the same.
Yeah. Now I'm smiling because I've always thought, you know, when we talked about innovation again, I spent a few years in Silicon Valley. And the role of the leader my takeaway from my time there was the role of the leader was to create the environment for innovation to thrive. And that environment's really important. So that's about, you know, what's accepted behavior, what's encouraged, what's rewarded. Like you said, leaders being vulnerable themselves, not knowing all of the answers, but also bringing in the expertise and applying it to the way things are changing. So
actually, when you think of apparel and footwear,
like 20 years
that
ago,
that happened even before,
yes.
right?
Yes.
Remember how there used to be, you know, you used to have your summer and winter season, yes. and then you'd have your fall, winter,
right.
spring, summer season, and then it was every 6 weeks
yeah.
there was a release.
Right.
So they've already been through that shift.
Yeah. Companies like Zara,
yes.
Or were one of the, I think, leaders in
the
quick turn,
yes, yes.
seasonal turnaround,
Absolutely.
Or at least the collection.
And then you also look at some big high street brands that didn't survive because they couldn't adapt. And that was all supply chain.
Really? So let's talk about a little bit about, like, apparel. You talked about shoes in
yes.
particular. Tell me a little bit about, so there are parallels, what we've seen in other industries. I talked about banking. You talked about apparel. And even, was it also bikes that you were talking about, or
yeah, but I think that the life cycle of apparel and footwear is far quicker.
Okay, let's talk about that. Like,
yeah.
what happened and who is?
I am not an expert, but all I can say from now, like looking in, is that they actually went through this dynamic planning shift years ago, right? And they had to change their whole way of working. Their models, their pricing models, their sourcing models, etc. So there's a lot to be learned from what they've done. And then you look at, we all know that the footwear industry has been through huge pressure as well. And there's obviously a lot more insurgent brands as well. But what they've done is they've actually simplified. So the winners are now simplifying, right? So less launches, less innovation, but when they come out with innovation, it's really obviously meaningful.
I was reading some news just this morning.
Yeah.
It was one of the UK big CPG companies, and their whole strategy was simplifying the portfolio. It was simple as that. Like, and which probably took some really tough choices, but like every brand has, is kind of right on purpose. And they feel like, you know, even though they've had to rationalize the portfolio, they feel like they're in a place to really accelerate now. So that portfolio rationalization is one thing. And also it's not just like, what's the, it's also for every SKU you have, every product you have, there's amount of energy, resources you have to allocate.
Yeah. And so you have to have fewer bets, right? Fewer, bigger bets.
So we've also talked about the example of consumer electronics, an industry that's gone through this kind of change long ago. Let's talk a little bit about what we can learn from that industry.
It's about availability. It's about performance, right? And you can have an amazing story and you can have all the innovation and all the tech, but if your supply chain hasn't made sure that, you know, first of all, you have a great product, but then also that it's available, that's where consumer electronics has really had to shift dramatically.
Absolutely.
You were saying companies are rationalizing, right?
Yeah.
I think it's an exercise, not just a pure rationalization. I think it's an exercise of looking at your value pools and where you need to play.
Yes.
So it's not where, it's not just where you are today. It's what the opportunity would be in the future as well. So once again, this is where I believe that AI can help to overlay, you know, with the data, making sure you obviously have the right data. You can identify what success will look like in 3 to 5 years' time.
That far out.
Yeah, absolutely. Africa's a good example, right?
Right.
Just based on population growth, et cetera. And you look at generations as well. Although saying that, we don't exactly know what's going to be happening with Gen Alpha yet, but still.
Like you said, it seems to be like a direction of travel, and there are some macro things that we can see happening in front of us, and you can place some bets in that. But then when it comes down to the in-month, in-quarter, in-year execution, that's where the speed and agility matters most. Is that a fair
absolutely. Statement? If we just shift slightly to go back to AlkBev, right? We all know that there's a level of moderation that's happening, right? So the markets in certain categories are shrinking. But I mentioned it previously, what's really interesting is that it's also how consumers are actually are drinking as well. So they are drinking, but it's becoming occasion-based drinking.
Right.
So less about just purchasing at the supermarket or the bottle shop. And it's more about making it a special moment.
Right.
So you can still capture the opportunity, but you do need to change how you are embedded in culture.
Right. What about adjacency? What about marijuana and getting into that space? Because we have seen some companies that have looked into that, and there's certainly in some geographies where that's becoming a reality, where that's a choice for people. And not to mention the low-no movement as well.
Yes, but I think it's also overlaid once again with what's happening with GLP-1, with Ozempic and Mounjaro.
We haven't talked about that. That's very important.
Because, you know, I was speaking to somebody last week, and this person is a really big wine connoisseur, and he's on Mounjaro, and he was like, I have zero desire to tuck into my wine collection.
Wow.
And it's just so, and then we know that, you know, if you think about what's happening in crisps.
Yeah, and quick service restaurants.
And snacks. Like they are already planning for this whole new GLP-1 influx.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
So that's where it becomes a never normal world.
It's really a pleasure to actually work with you, Anya, because I think what's really great is like how you bring the operating experience to Elixir, which I think is like totally important this day and age.
I do smile because often I'll hear the strategy and then I'm thinking, okay, well, what would this mean for me in my day-to-day world? So it's easy to say, you know, oh, let's go and, you know, do this big project and look at value pools and rationalization, et cetera. But how does that impact my people, my day-to-day life, and, you know, the organization as a whole?
Absolutely.
And so I think it's fun, you know.
And as we discuss and as we're learning ourselves working together in the market, strategy and execution are so tied together these days. You can't just have a strategy that gets handed to a team to execute. Does not work.
No, it doesn't.
So.
And then you have to be, you know, agile as well.
Yeah.
Like, so, yeah. You know, really ensuring that you can be tactical regardless of your strategy.
Yeah. And I think one of my biggest takeaways from this conversation is the importance of leadership, how critical it really is, especially in this moment, to really learn, be vulnerable, be willing to change, be open-minded, because our teams need and our companies need pretty strong leadership.
So basically, for me, I like to say it's about humanizing leadership, because, you know, gone are the days of telling people what to do,
right?
And, you know, how to do it. Now it's about asking the right questions. It's about listening and learning from others around you who probably have far more or have different takes on things, and maybe have a different opinion.
That might be more relevant for the consumers you're trying to serve.
Exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
So, it's a very different leader.
Yeah. Well, it's been a real pleasure, Anya.
Thank you.
Thanks. I look forward to doing more out in the market together.
Right.
Thanks.